you know, the abortion industry wants us to believe that women are 100% sure that this is absolutely what they wanted. And abortion pill reversal speaks to the exact opposite of that, which is what we actually see in practice.
Welcome to another very exciting episode of Dear Jane. I'm Marcy. This is Scott. How's it
Hello.
Going, Scott?
Going well.
Good. I am super excited for today's guest. She is going to break down a lot of cultural, popular talking points and explain the truth behind them. Because I don't know if you know this, not everything that you see and hear online is reliable.
Yep. We're going to get scientific, but we're going to do it in a way that even I can understand. So that's encouraging for anybody who's like, uh-oh, here we go, biology class. But we're going to have some really good pushback to some of the nonsense we hear from the mainstream doctors groups out there. So very, very excited to talk to Dr. Christina Francis today on Dear Jane.
Dr. Francis, thanks so much for joining us today on Dear Jane.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I want to just jump in because I live in a state where this has been heavily, I was going to say debated. It hasn't really been debated. It's just been decided. Why do you think abortion pill reversal is so attacked and demonized by the pro-choice movement?
That was such a great question, actually. And I have, you know, I don't know that I know the answer for sure. I have my theories, and I'll share my theories with you all. So, you know, of course, abortion pill reversal is something that provides, I think it's Heartbeat International that coined this term, but a second chance at choice. So it really is just a choice for a woman who has started the chemical abortion process and then just changes her mind and you know, regrets that decision and wants to save her baby. And it simply gives her that opportunity to try to save her baby. It doesn't force this upon any woman. It doesn't tell any woman that she can't get an abortion. It just simply provides this opportunity for women that regret their abortions. And we know that they do. You know, the calls to the Abortion Pill Reversal Network, from what they're telling me, have gone up. I certainly have gotten received more calls to potentially provide this for women in the last, I would say, 6 to 9 months than I did in the several years before that I have been providing APR. I think that that those who oppose it for two different reasons. And one is, in order to want to save her child, there has to be something there to save, right? So I think abortion pill reversal really points out the humanity of that preborn child, that if this was just a clump of tissue or a clump of cells or not her child yet, why would she want to save that, you know? And so I think that it really highlights the humanity of that preborn child. And so obviously the abortion industry is opposed to anything that humanizes preborn children. But also I think because it shows that women actually aren't empowered by abortion and aren't sure about their abortion decisions when they make it. And that really goes to the heart of the abortion industry, you know, and they are opposed to anything that says that there's anything wrong with abortion, to say that women regret their abortions. They're opposed to anything that would indicate that. And so I think that's the other reason is, you know, in this cultural movement where women have been told that they should shout their abortions and that it's empowering, anything that says otherwise is, they try to shut it down. And so, you know, I think it really, like I said, it speaks to the fact that we know a significant number of women do actually regret their decision to start an abortion. And also it shows that so many women are not sure about their decision because they're oftentimes rushed into it by the abortion clinic that they, or, you know, if many women now are getting these drugs through a website where they're given really no informed consent, no real counseling. They're just shuttled quickly into taking these drugs. And so many women are in crisis situations, very difficult circumstances when they make these decisions. And I think anyone listening to this understands, you know, if we all look back on decisions we made in our life in moments of crisis and moments of pressure, probably many of us can say we wouldn't make that same decision if we had a clear mind about us at the time. And that's the women, or that's the situation that women oftentimes find themselves in. And so, you know, the abortion industry wants us to believe that women are 100% sure that this is absolutely what they wanted. And abortion pill reversal speaks to the exact opposite of that, which is what we actually see in practice.
For those who don't know, how does the pill work, and generally how effective is it?
Yeah, absolutely. So in order to understand how abortion pill reversal works, people need to understand how the abortion drugs work. So the main drug that we talk about when we talk about chemical abortions is mifepristone. Some people may still know the old name for it, RU486. And the way that that works is it basically blocks the effects of progesterone, which is a key hormone in early pregnancy that really enables the mom and baby to establish good connections so that blood with oxygen and the nutrients that baby needs can flow freely between mom and baby. When you don't have progesterone around, then those connections either don't develop or they break down those, or it breaks down those connections, essentially leading to starvation and asphyxiation of that developing baby. So the way abortion pill reversal works is it works through a basic biochemical principle that anyone who's taken a biochemistry class will know about this, called reversible competitive inhibition. So basically what that means is mifepristone is given to compete with progesterone for binding sites on receptors. And so what you can do is you can flood the woman's system with progesterone, and then it outcompetes the mifepristone. So if you think of it as two keys trying to vie for place in a lock, one of which will open the lock and one of which won't, that's essentially what's happening. And so we want to give more keys that will actually open the lock through giving more progesterone, so that it can displace or compete for those sites with mifepristone and then have the effect that it's meant to have. And so that's, in a nutshell, how it works. It's using natural progesterone that's been used in the field of obstetrics for 50 plus years. It's mm-hmm. used all the time by infertility doctors. We know that it's got a long track record of safety in pregnancy. And it works in this case, at least based on the data we have, it works about 68% of the time. And it's important to compare that to if we were to do nothing. So if a woman were to take that first drug, mifepristone, not take the second drug of the cocktail, which is called misoprostol, which essentially induces labor, but then also not take any progesterone. So say she changed her mind, but we just didn't do anything. We know based on the studies that we have that in that situation, at most, 23% of those babies will survive. So by giving progesterone, we increase the likelihood that baby will survive from 23% all the way up to 68%. So while it's not 100%, that's a significant improvement in chance of survival for that baby.
Yeah, and I'm just trying to think, you know, through the scientific arguments against, which we know what the reason is. We know, you know, you outlined pretty well why we think that this is... why the other side doesn't like APR so much. It just doesn't sound like, I mean, are there significant side effects? I mean, what scientific argument do they try to make, if any?
Well, they do try and make it, but it is so flimsy. I mean, and to me, it's crazy that physicians don't see through the argument of the other side. So I would say the leading voice against abortion pill reversal is ACOG, the American College of OBGYNs, who claim to be the premier association for OBs in this country. But they are extremely pro-abortion due to ideological reasons, not due to medical evidence. And so they have claimed that abortion pill reversal is junk science, stating that there's no evidence to support its efficacy, when in fact we know that's not true. We have animal studies, we have the manufacturer's own studies of mifepristone, we have basic principles of biochemistry, as well as human case series that have shown that it's effective, that where we get that 68% number from. They also, so they try to claim that there's no randomized controlled trials to support its efficacy. Now, on that, I actually would agree with them that we don't. The reason that we don't have that is twofold. One, there was one that was attempted by an abortionist, Mitchell Krynan from UCSF Bixby, which for anybody who sort of runs in the abortion world, you'll know about the Bixby Center. It's a very pro-abortion center at the University of California in San Francisco. So Mitchell Krynan is an abortionist there who took women who were seeking surgical abortions and then enrolled them in this trial if they gave their consent. And basically what they did was they made two groups, one of whom got the abortion drug mifepristone followed by a placebo, and one of whom got mifepristone followed by progesterone. Now, this study was stopped early for safety concerns because they had three women who went to the emergency room for heavy bleeding. So the other side will claim, oh, look, abortion pill reversal is unsafe. The study had to be stopped early due to safety concerns. What they don't tell you, and what you will see very easily if you read the study, is that only one of the women who went to the emergency room actually got progesterone, and she was found to be completing her abortion, unfortunately, but required no treatment, no blood transfusion, no surgeries. She was discharged home. The other four women in the study who got progesterone actually had live pregnancies 2 weeks later. So the progesterone worked 80% of the time in that group to save their baby. The other group though that got placebo, two women from that group went to the emergency room, both of whom needed emergency surgery due to incomplete abortions and massive hemorrhage, and one needed a blood transfusion. So actually, the danger came from the abortion drug, not from giving progesterone. And only two women in that group, so 40%, had ongoing pregnancies. So that's a very small study. We can't draw significant conclusions from it. But the other side, well, that is literally the only study they quote to say that abortion pill reversal doesn't work and that it's unsafe. The reason why we say it would be unethical to do a randomized controlled trial between placebo and progesterone is because we know progesterone works. And so if a woman is coming to us and asking for us to help her save her baby, it would be completely unethical to give her a placebo when we have something that we know is effective. And we see this in other areas of medicine. This is not just, you know, related to abortion pill reversal. We see it in other areas where we have something that we have a pretty good sense that it works, but we want to find out more information about it. And then we do studies that don't involve placebo, again, because it would be unethical. So this is not unusual. Like I said, it's done in other areas of medicine. But, you know, the other side will claim we need more studies. We agree. In fact, we have researchers who are working on more research now to look and see, is there maybe a more effective dose that we could be using, that we could get that number from 68% even higher. Mm-hmm. But again, it would be unethical to give a woman placebo who wants to save her baby because we know that it works. And even the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, they are not pro-life at all, but they have very clear statements stating that natural progesterones are very safe in the first trimester of pregnancy and that they can be effective for women with threatened pregnancy loss, which is essentially what this is. This is a what we call an iatrogenic or a doctor-caused threatened pregnancy loss because a woman has taken mifepristone that is threatening to end her pregnancy. So we have lots of evidence to support it. One study that tries to claim that it shows that APR doesn't work when in fact it actually did show that it worked. But that's all the other side has to really rest their statements on. Unfortunately, because ACOG, again, is seen as sort of the premier society, and I think lots of people think, why would they say anything if it wasn't evidence-based? All they have to do is say this is junk science. And unfortunately, a lot of physicians, a lot of courts, a lot of state legislators believe them in that, even though they have absolutely zero evidence to back that up.
That's so wild to me because I think as soon as people understand that APR is progesterone, like that's what it is, then a lot of people understand, oh, that's what my friend was given to help prevent miscarriage or to help, you know, strengthen the pregnancy. When you were talking about the women who had to go to the emergency room for heavy bleeding and other things, my first thought was, oh, I thought that was a pretty well-known side effect of mifepristone, mm-hmm. you know, the abortion pill. And yeah, that's something the other side, the only thing we hear in mainstream media about the abortion pill is you know, it's as safe as going to get your teeth clean, you know, going to the dentist, things like that. And it just, there's a lot of risks that I think people don't know about when it comes to mifepristone. I don't know if you want to speak to any of those, but that's just where my mind went, is like, actually. Speaking of abortion pill reversal, there is a website and a hotline number that you should know about in case you know someone or hear of someone who has started the abortion pill process and regrets it. Just like Dr. Francis was talking about, there is a way that you can try to reverse the effects of taking that first abortion pill. So the website you need to have just locked in, ready to go, is abortionpillreversal.com. There's a 24/7 helpline number that you can call or that anyone can call for information on local clinics. So these can be pregnancy centers, hospitals, other doctor's offices where women can receive abortion pill reversal treatment to try to reverse the effects of mifepristone, that first abortion pill. So for you to be equipped and to be able to help, if you hear of someone who needs this service, go to abortionpillreversal.com. You can look up the helpline number, plug that into your phone so it's always ready to go. This is a great resource to have on hand and in our pro-life arsenal as we're talking with people and want to have those resources available.
No, absolutely. You're right. And it's this lie that's being sold. And of course, now because of the FDA's completely reckless actions, which I'm hopeful will be reversed now that we're going to have some people with sense, hopefully in charge of the FDA. But, you know, the FDA has now made it so that these drugs can just be dispensed online, you know, arrive to a woman's home through the mail with no interaction with a medical professional whatsoever, no oversight, no follow-up. And it's, women are told it's safer than Tylenol. It's totally fine. You can do this from the comfort of your own home. What they're not told is that chemical abortions or the abortion drugs are actually 4 times more dangerous than surgical abortions, which I think surprises a lot of people because I think we just inherently think, oh, medicine must be safer than surgery. You know, I mean, I think that's a normal thing for people to think, but it's actually not in this case. It is much more dangerous for women. Even the FDA's own label says that 1 in 25 women who take these drugs, even under the most ideal circumstances where they're evaluated by a physician, we know how far along they are, all of that, 1 in 25 women will end up going to the emergency room due to complications. And those most common complications are heavy bleeding, incomplete abortion, where some of the tissue is still retained in her uterus, and infection. And in fact, we've had over 30 deaths in this country related to these drugs. And the most common cause is infection. We saw that, you know, people may remember hearing about the cases out of Georgia that were ProPublica reported on, and of course tried to blame it on Georgia's abortion law, was in no way related to Georgia's abortion law. In fact, those 2 women died from complications of the abortion drugs. And Amber Thurman specifically died from a very bad infection, which is what we see with these drugs. One in particular, actually, there's, and not a lot of people talk about this, so I think it's important to bring it up. There's one particular kind of bacteria that this drug puts you at an increased risk of an infection from. Mm. The real danger of that particular bacteria is when it causes sepsis or a blood infection. It causes a very atypical kind of sepsis. So that women will not present with the sort of the standard symptoms and presentations that we normally see with sepsis. They will look actually less sick initially until all of a sudden they get extremely sick and they go into multi-system organ failure within just a few hours. Now, I don't know because I don't have access to Amber Thurman's records, but when I read at least what we have publicly available, to me, it sounds like she died from that kind of sepsis. And it also points out the importance of doctors who are, so of course, abortionists are not caring for these complications, right? Especially when they're dispensing these drugs online. What are women told? They're told, if you experience problems, go to your emergency room and just tell them that you're having a miscarriage. Don't even tell them that you took these drugs. This is why it's so dangerous for that to happen, because then doctors like me are getting called down to the emergency room and we're running blind here, right? We have no idea what has gone on. If she doesn't tell us that she took these drugs, we won't know. And then we may not think to suspect this really atypical kind of sepsis, and we may delay necessary treatment, you know, that she needs, because we're just not, aware that she took these drugs. So, so I just wanted to make that point, because I think that's something that not a lot of people are talking about, but that actually leads to a delay in appropriate care for women, because we don't have the appropriate information that we need to take care of her.
Switching gears to something else that is in the news quite a bit right now. We have talked about IVF several times on Dear Jane. Marcy's all over it. She totally understands it. As you've probably figured out, she's the brains and I'm the good looking one of the organization. But so help me get my mind around IVF. Why is it so problematic?
Yeah, well, and this is a real hot button issue, as I'm sure you guys have, you've addressed it, right? Because even amongst the pro-life community, there are disagreements over this issue. And so, but I think it's really important for us to talk about, because sort of, I think the party line right now is, well, IVF leads to more babies. We want more babies, right? So this is a good thing. And yes, more babies are a good thing, absolutely, but we have to think about how we get there, you know, and is that process ethical or isn't it? Because, you know, the ends can't justify the means, obviously. So we need to think through that. The other thing is that IVF is a very unregulated industry in the U.S. And while some reproductive endocrinologists, so those are the doctors who specialize in infertility, while some may impose their own ethical framework around how they do IVF, there's nothing forcing that. And IVF is also very lucrative. And so you can see how that's a perfect setup. Very little regulation for something that's very lucrative. That's a setup for this to be abused. And so I think there's a number of things that we need to think about. And also acknowledging the fact that infertility is a deeply painful experience for those who experience it. And, you know, I certainly can empathize with people who are willing to do almost anything in order to have a child, because that is such a painful experience for so many people. But again, I think we have to be careful and remember that the ends can't always justify the means. And so the real problem with IVF, and this is not coming from a, you know, there are certainly some religions that might say that they oppose IVF for one reason or another, but I'm coming at it not from a religious perspective, but just from a, we must respect all human beings equally. And we know the science is very clear that human beings, we come into existence and we are human beings from the moment of fertilization. At the moment that happens, we have a new, distinct, living and whole human being. That doesn't matter where that human being is, whether they are in a petri dish or inside of their mothers, they are a human being. And so, you know, we, those of us who believe in human equality for all human beings at all stages of development, have to believe that those embryos that are created through IVF have just as much worth or value as an embryo created naturally inside of mom, as well as living, you know, born human beings. So that's one thing, is we have to think, okay, are the way that these embryos created through IVF, that they're being treated, would we be okay with born human beings being treated in the same way? Mm-hmm. And so when you put it in that framework, then you start to see the significant problems here. Mm-hmm. So we know that only about 7% of human beings that are created through IVF will actually make it to a live birth. 7%. Mm-hmm. Wow. That is a minuscule amount, especially when you look at the number of human beings that are alive today because of IVF. I mean, it's in the millions. So then if that represents 7%, then the number of human beings that were actually created is in the hundreds of millions. So, you know, how do only 7% make it to a live birth? Well, there's a number of things that happen. First, some will naturally die, just like with, you know, natural miscarriage. So that certainly happens, yes. But we also know that sometimes, now this is less now than it used to be, but in the beginnings of IVF, they would create 20, 30 embryos from one IVF cycle. And of course you can't implant 20 or 30 embryos because moms can't be pregnant with that many babies at once. And so then these embryos would be frozen, or they would be, they're looked at under the microscope and they are graded. Talk about eugenics. I mean, this really is eugenics. They are graded based on how likely they look to be able to make it to a full-term pregnancy, or at least, you know, a pregnancy that can survive until viability. The problem with that grading system is actually very imprecise. It's based on small studies. And even the lowest grade of embryos, actually, when you look at this, even the small studies that they have, still 30 to 50% of them would go on to a live birth. So this doesn't mean they have 0% chance of survival. So those that are graded as low quality might just be discarded, thrown away. So a human being thrown away. Mm. Or they might be donated for research. And research is being done, destructive research is being done on living human beings. These are human beings. Or they may end up stored indefinitely, cryopreserved indefinitely. And, you know, these are all things that I think prospective or parents, I mean, once they have embryos, they are parents, are not told when they start this process. What are you going to do? If you end up with 12 embryos, are you willing to implant all 12 of them at some point in time to give all of them a chance at life? You know, then sometimes a few embryos might be transferred. Now, again, this is frowned upon, but there's nothing that specifically prohibits doctors from doing this. They may transfer 3 embryos. Well, then what happens if all 3 implant and continue to grow? Or maybe 1 or 2 of them split and then you end up with quintuplets. That places mom and babies at significant risk. Doesn't mean they can't go on to deliver and all of them survive, but it does place them at risk. So then a lot of doctors will recommend what they call selective reduction, which is a euphemistic term for selective abortions to exterminate certain babies. And then they might choose based on the gender of that baby. Well, I really only wanted 3 girls and 2 of them are boys. So let's end the lives of those 2 boys. I'm not trying to make light of this. It just, I mean, this is what is happening. Or genetic diagnosis is done on the embryos before they're transferred for implantation. And any that aren't genetically perfect then are screened out. So this is the situation that we find ourselves in, not even to get into the whole surrogacy situation, how that's so exploitative of women, the buying and selling of gametes. So eggs and sperm also exploits women and men. So there are a lot of issues. And I, you know, again, I know so many people feel very differently on this issue. So many people have had children through IVF. And this is not diminishing in any way the value of the lives of children who are born through IVF. In fact, those of us who are raising concerns, these ethical concerns with IVF, are actually saying, actually, all of these children are extremely valuable and we should be treating them all with respect and dignity. And so, you know, I really think that our country needs to grapple with this. And, you know, on a policy level, do I think that we need to ban IVF? I don't think we probably can do this in that country or do that in this country. But I do think that there are policies that we could put into place that at least would strive to make it very ethical. APLOG, the organization that I lead, put out a white paper this last year on the ethical treatment of human embryos. It's pretty detailed, so if anybody wants to take a deep dive, it's available on our website. But it looks and grapples with a lot of these issues.
One thing you said that I think is really helpful, as I've thought through, just related more to the abortion side of things in talking with people, debating with people, is when you talked about if we were treating grown adults or even children this way, would we be okay with that? And then when you were talking about the medical experimentation, you know, your mind kind of goes back to some of the atrocities, at least of the 20th century, and things that we would vehemently be opposed to and be able to authoritatively say, like, no, this is wrong, we shouldn't do this. When it comes to the issue of IVF, I think it's hard because we don't see the embryo, most of us. You know, we're talking about something that we're never going to see. We also know that we're talking about people, living, breathing, walking people on this planet now who were conceived through IVF, and that's their story. And like you said, we certainly don't want to diminish their value as human beings. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't have this very hard conversation, and probably should have had it decades ago before all of this really took off. But yeah, I just think about all of the embryos that are kind of suspended in time and frozen. And what are some of the maybe redemptive parts of IVF? Is there a way to, obviously we know people are alive today through IVF. That's redemptive. I know about adoption that can happen through this, but what are some of the maybe like good things that can come from it and that can help us kind of piece together what we should do moving forward when it comes to something like IVF?
Yeah, well, you know, I think there are things that we can do to minimize the sort of ethical quandary that we find ourselves in right now with IVF. Certainly the, you know, again, I want to emphasize that the value and the worth of the lives of any human being that's walking on the planet that was conceived through IVF, affirm that they are in no way less human or less valuable because they were conceived in that way. And I think a lot of parents of children conceived through IVF, even, you know, those who may still have frozen embryos, find themselves in a very difficult situation that they probably weren't actually counseled about, you know, and now they're kind of in this situation and now what do I do? You know, the one thing I think that is there that does try to redeem some of this is the availability of embryo adoption. You know, we have there's not an exact number, but we think we probably have somewhere between 1 and 2 million frozen embryos in this country. So 1 in 2 million children who are just suspended in time and waiting for a chance at life. We know that there's a pretty high loss rate with them when they're unfrozen. I mean, that procedure has gotten much better, that we lose fewer embryos in the thawing process now than we used to. But then even the transfer to either their own mother's uterus or an adoptive mother's uterus, you know, there's a fairly high loss rate there. But at least we can give these children a chance at life through embryo adoption, which is a really beautiful way for women who haven't been able to conceive on their own or even have. I have friends who have their own biological children but care very deeply about these children as well, these frozen children, and have adopted embryos to give them a chance at life. I know one family who has 3 children alive now through the beauty of embryo adoption. It gives moms still a chance to experience pregnancy as well. But, you know, I think focusing on, I'm a huge fan of Katie Faust, and probably many people know her, Them Before Us, who talks about the fact, though, that all of our interventions in this, whether it be sort of traditional adoption, embryo adoption, all of that, all of this should be geared at what is best for the children, not what is best for the adults in the room or the adults that are involved. That we really need to be thinking about what's best for these children. And of course, for those children that are sort of suspended in time right now, the best thing for them is to have a chance at life. And so I think, you know, that can be something good that can come out of this, but we really do need to be having discussions. There's a lot of things to talk about surrounding IVF. Again, the ends can't justify the means, so this needs to be done in an ethical way. But also, IVF has really become, you know, it used to be that IVF was sort of the last alternative for couples that were facing infertility. So you tried everything else, nothing else is working, you can't find any other reason for the infertility that you could potentially treat, then IVF was kind of a last resort. IVF has just become a workaround around the entire situation now, that many people are just going straight to IVF. Not all, but many are. And there's a new movement now within medicine called restorative reproductive medicine that actually gets to the heart of what is causing the infertility in this couple. Is there a health issue with the man? Is there a health issue with the woman? That treating that not only will allow them to be able to conceive, but will treat this health condition for the rest of her life, you know, beyond when she's having babies. So to me, that's where we really need to be putting our money as far as research goes, to be able to address these health issues for women and men, and also hopefully help them achieve a pregnancy as well. And the research that we do have actually shows that the restorative reproductive medicine approach, it actually has higher success rates than IVF, and couples that have failed IVF can actually succeed in getting pregnant using this restorative reproductive medicine approach. So I'm a big fan of pushing for that in policy, pushing for money to do more research in that, and training. It's not something that in my OBGYN training, I got training in infertility. No one ever even talked about restorative reproductive medicine. And that's still the case in many training programs. And so we need to be increasing access to that as well. And then if I can just one more thing too, just to jump back to what you were referencing, you know, with experimentation being done on human beings and do we tolerate it? You know, one really dark part of sort of medical research history is the Tuskegee experiment. And many people have probably heard about that. But if you haven't, it was an experiment that was done without the consent of hundreds of African-American men who were diagnosed with syphilis. They had a known treatment available, and they withheld that treatment to see what happens if we don't treat syphilis. Mm-hmm. And these men died or became severely disabled because of the effects of syphilis. Did we learn something? Did we get good medical knowledge out of that experiment? Unfortunately, yeah, we did. I mean, now we know what happens if you don't treat syphilis. However, that did not justify that experimentation on those human beings. They did not consent, and that was abuse of them. And I think the same, we need to utilize that same thought process anytime we're thinking about experimentation on embryos. They have not given their consent. And honestly, it doesn't matter what kind of medical knowledge we would get out of it. It's wrong. And we should not be experimenting on human beings without their consent.
Yeah, I think this is another example of where our policies and our cultural decisions that we're making have gotten way far ahead of any of our ethical thinking and bioethical thinking about this issue. So I'm grateful for people like you who are able to break it down for people in such an easy to understand way. This is something, a topic I'm really passionate about and wish that more people understood. And I understand, like, especially when couples are going at it through the heartache of not being able to conceive and they really want to have a child, but we have ethical considerations that we need to think about. Tell us a little bit about APLOG and any maybe new initiatives that you guys are working on or what's coming down the pipeline for y'all as an organization.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are a professional medical organization, actually the largest in the world for life-affirming medical professionals. So lots of OBGYNs, that's sort of our biggest segment of our membership, but also many other specialties within medicine, including midwives and family medicine doctors and many specialties. I always tell people, if you practice medicine and you treat women and you're life-affirming, you have a place in APLOG. So that's who we are. We're nearing 8,000 members, which is really, really exciting across the country and even internationally. And we've got a few things that we're working on in 2025, which we're really excited about. We just really see the need to take back our profession in a way and sort of forge a new path forward towards life-affirming medicine. Unfortunately, medicine has become very death heavy. You know, when we look at the issue of physician-assisted suicide and abortion, and just we've gotten away from respecting the dignity of every human being, which really undergirds the best way to practice medicine. When you lose respect for the dignity of every patient that's sitting in front of you, that's a scary place to be in medicine. And so we really see the need now to take back, like I said, our profession and restore that respect for the dignity of our patients. And so we're planning on doing that in a number of ways. One thing that we're doing is bringing attention to the fact that many of our medical societies have had really ideological capture by the abortion industry. And so their recommendations are not based on solid medical evidence and what's best for our patients, but rather serving a political agenda. And so we're gonna be highlighting that, highlighting things like ACOG saying we should no longer use words like living when we're talking to babies, or baby, or heartbeat. I mean, I don't know about you, but I guarantee my patients don't want to come into my office and me say, I'm going to listen to your fetus's electrical impulse right now. You know, I mean, it's ridiculous. So we're going to be exposing some of those things this year. But also we really feel a burden for supporting and nurturing the next generation of life-affirming medical professionals. I just came off of our national conference, which was amazing. We had almost 80 medical students and residents there. And I can't even tell you how encouraging they were to me to know this is the future of medicine. The future looks bright if they are the future of medicine. So, but they are in such a vulnerable place right now. They're being told they need to be silent if they are pro-life, that they need to endorse abortion, that they need to endorse physician-assisted suicide, you know, all of these other issues that are sort of cultural hot buttons right now, that they are being told that they need to shut up if they don't agree and they need to kind of go along to get along. And they're feeling very, I think, discouraged and vulnerable. And one of the greatest things to me was to hear them say how encouraged they were to know that they're not alone when they were at our conference with, you know, 350 other people. So that was really exciting. So we're working on some initiatives to help support them better, to strengthen conscience protections on a federal level as well as at a state level, so that they can know that they can practice medicine according to their convictions and not be worried about losing their job or being kicked out of their training program because of that. And then also working to encourage our members to get more involved with pregnancy centers, because we know that pregnancy centers are providing such crucial services to women, and they're under attack right now, as we were talking about earlier, by states, whether it be related to abortion pill reversal or something else. So we're really going to be working hard to help, to encourage our members to get involved so that hopefully more pregnancy centers can be providing medical care and medical services to women. To show, again, the beauty of life-affirming medicine. So lots more going on, but those are just a few of the things that we're going to be working on this year.
I love that. I hate that in a profession where you guys take an oath to do no harm, that so much of the politics and the mainstream narratives seep in to impact the quality and the level of care that medical professionals should be able to provide without any sort of outside pressure to the contrary. So I love APLOG and what you guys are doing, and just all, like I said, I feel like I could sit and listen to you talk all day about these issues. You just break them down in such a helpful way for people. So if people want to learn more about APLOG, maybe we have some medical students listening or people in the medical professional sphere, how can they follow what you're doing and maybe get involved?
Yeah, absolutely. So one way would be to go to our website. It's aaplog.org. You can find all of our resources there, ways to join. Medical students and residents can join for free and get all the benefits of a dues-paying membership. So I'd encourage you to go there. We also are on all the major social media platforms, Instagram, X, I still want to say Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, soon coming out on TikTok, I hear, so from my team. So you can follow us on social media as well. The other thing I should mention too is that this past year we released a series of videos, and we're really promoting them this year, medical education videos. So we have one on abortion pill reversal that reviews all of the scientific evidence that supports it, as well as one on how to practice obstetrics or OBE practice in states that have abortion laws. And so what we really wanted to do is help doctors in those states to understand you can still provide the same excellent healthcare that you've been providing to your patients. The only thing that can't be done are elective abortions. And it's a really excellent video as well. And so if people want to check into that, they can go to meded.applog.org.
Awesome. aaplog.org is that website, so you guys can check that out. Dr. Christina Francis, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks again for listening to Dear Jane.
You can follow along every day on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and X. And make sure you also are subscribed so you never miss an episode on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, as well as YouTube. Ring that bell so you're notified and you never miss an episode.